He sits in his room with his diary balanced on his lap. The words flow effortlessly because they're always at the forefront of his mind. He's heard that if he can visualize the things he wants powerfully enough, they will come to be. Action is required too, though. And he's already started on that part. He watched her come home today. She's consistent. And after weeks of doing this, he can now predict her patterns with relative certainty. Soon, he will manifest what he wants. But it will be less through a mysterious power of the universe and more through the violence that flows from his own hands. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 177, The Murder of Lynette Volskenk. I have something special lined up alongside this week's episode, a bonus interview with the true crime author and filmmaker Tim Tate, who I had the chance to talk to about his new and exclusive series coming to CBS Justice called The Hunt for the Chameleon Killer. Over three episodes, the series reveals the global hunt which took place for Elaine Parent, dubbed the Chameleon Killer, who was at one time the most wanted woman in the world, and who managed to evade US law enforcement for over 12 years, while stealing a string of identities along the way. I had the great pleasure of talking to Tim about how a tiny sheriff's office in Florida managed to connect Elaine Parent to the murder of 34-year-old Beverly McGowan in 1990, whose headless, handless body was discovered in a local canal, and the dramatic end to the police search. Sometimes truth really is stranger than fiction, and this is an insightful conversation you won't want to miss. You can watch all three episodes of The Hunt for the Chameleon Killer exclusively on DSTV Channel 170 from the 21st to the 23rd of March. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Harry Nell, Tay Ganyani, Carmen Bartman, Senotando, Krishna Opperman, Karen Huss, Clawney, and Krista Marie Kloster for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. The perpetrator of the crime in today's episode has been described by South Africa's most experienced profiler, Dr. Gerard Labiskagni as one of the most unique individuals he's ever seen. In most instances, that would be a huge compliment. But of course, in this case, it's a huge red flag. When a highly experienced profiler is intrigued by your criminal mind, you know things are pretty dark. And they are. This case is incredibly brutal and honestly terrifying. If you're a woman living on your own, I would highly recommend listening to this episode with caution, because there's a very good chance it's of all the episodes I've done will have you looking over your shoulder more often than not. Perhaps, though, what good can come of this is that we're all far more aware of exactly what type of individuals are really out there, if we needed a reminder. In researching this episode, I used the sentencing and judgment documents from the case, several media articles, several social media sources, and an episode of Dr. Labiskagni's podcast, Profiler Africa. So let's get into episode 177, the murder of Lynette Volskenk.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Lynette Volskenk was born in 1987. She and her sister grew up on the West Coast, and Lynette matriculated from Veldhoven High School in 2005. In the years that followed, she chose to study computer-aided drawing. Some of you may be familiar with the CAD program, engineering and drafting. She started working while she was studying and found great pleasure in helping to create machinery, homes, buildings, and other structures in her job. Lynette was incredibly close with her sister, brother-in-law, and her nephew. And although she'd had an occasional relationship, she hadn't yet found a person she wanted to spend the rest of her life with by the time her 20s ended. That really didn't seem to bother Lynette much, though. She was doing really well in her career, enjoyed living on her own, and spent holidays and weekends with her sister and brother-in-law. In 2013, Lynette started working at Liners Engineering in Tigerberg, and she soon moved into a block of flats in Belleville called Siersig. She often took pictures of the incredible view of the northern suburbs of Cape Town, especially at night, when twinkling lights stretched out as far as the eye could see. It's always interesting to me to look at how the paths of the victim and the perpetrator, in a case, weave and cross over throughout their lives before eventually ending up at the point at which we find them. Lynette started primary school in 1994, and the following year, in a town 1,200 kilometres away from Veldhoven, a baby boy was born to two struggling human beings. When Kyle Raters was born in Boksburg, Gauteng, his mother and father were deep in the bowels of substance use disorders. His mom and dad weren't married, and his mom lived with her parents, Kyle's grandparents, with his dad popping into the house mostly to collect Kyle's mom so they could go score drugs. Kyle was often left with his grandparents, who did their best to raise the little boy, but they themselves were struggling financially and with their health, so caring for a baby was incredibly difficult. Eventually, when Kyle was 17 months old, his mother and father left the home permanently, essentially abandoning him with his grandparents. As hard as his grandparents tried to continue raising Kyle, they eventually had to admit that they just did not have the resources to give him what he deserved. And so they began considering their options and discussing them with their other daughter, Teresa, who lived in the Western Cape. Teresa was quite the opposite of her sister. She'd gone to study law after matriculating and became an advocate. She'd worked hard to get herself to the point of living a happy and successful middle-class life. The Raters now had a choice. Give Kyle up to the state and let him be fostered and hopefully eventually adopted, or at least try to keep him with the family. Teresa made the decision to take Kyle back to the Western Cape with her. She did not have any children of her own, but she couldn't watch her nephew be removed from his family. So, as hard as it was, she became a mother overnight. Teresa officially adopted Kyle soon after that, and it seems the family decided that for the time being at least, it would be best for the boy to believe that Teresa was his biological mother. He hadn't had much contact at all with his birth mother and had no bond to speak of with her. And so, he became Teresa's son. Kyle Raters would never have a bad word to say about his upbringing with Teresa or the woman herself. He attended Weinberg Boys High School and was a popular pupil. One of his schoolmates would later say that Kyle was really fun to be around and everyone liked him. He'd grown into an attractive young man, and although he engaged with girls quite a lot, there always seemed to be something that held him back from entering into relationships. Kyle's confidence often translated into arrogance, and his later diary entries would reveal a whole side to the young man that none of his schoolmates seemed to see, but very likely resulted in him not having very many meaningful relationships, especially with girls. Although Kyle didn't seem to struggle too much with social relationships at school, he did struggle academically. He had to repeat grades 4, 9, and 11, and would eventually matriculate at the age of 21. Interestingly, although his schoolmates said that Kyle fit in and was well-liked, that was not Kyle's experience. He felt that he was too different from his classmates, and he never felt like part of the inner crowd. It's fascinating to me how often this happens. How individuals like the man Kyle would become, or perhaps already was, have a deep sense of something about them being different from others, even at a very young age. Kyle began to use DACA during his school years, and although that is absolutely not uncommon at all, teenagers often experiment with DACA and alcohol, for Kyle it became a psychological crutch. And soon, he was seeking something stronger to make him feel, well, anything, really. There's a lot of research that points to substance use disorders being hereditary. That inheritance is partially genetic. But it's also down to the life experiences and resulting psychological impact that living within an environment of substance abuse brings. I have personal experience of this being true. That's not to say every child of an alcoholic will become an alcoholic or drug addict themselves, but it is interesting to see how that predisposition can play out going forward. And if you're aware of it from a young age, you can make choices which will keep you on a path that does not lead to substance addiction. But you definitely see it popping up in other areas of your life, if you're self-aware enough. Unfortunately, Kyle was seemingly not self-aware enough to steer himself away from this trap, and his DACA use was soon not enough, and progressed into harder drugs, such as TIC. After matriculating in 2016, he did not go on to study, as he didn't feel the academic field was where his talents lay. It's also important to point out that if Kyle's mother had been deep in her addiction when she was pregnant with him, she may have been using, and this could have resulted in learning difficulties for him. Kyle's IQ would later be tested, though, and he was found to be perfectly normal on a cognitive level. He had the same IQ as the vast majority of South Africans, and there was no deficit there. At some point during his childhood, Kyle had been provisionally diagnosed with ADHD, but he was never medicated for that. And later, when his actions would lead him to significant psychiatric evaluations, psychiatrists found that he did not have ADHD, although he may have had some features of it as a child. In his later teenage years, before he matriculated, Kyle made a discovery which likely only added to his existing emotional turmoil. There's no information about how he found out that he was in fact adopted, whether he was sat down and told, or he'd found out some other way, but it's clear the revelation was understandably difficult for him. For his entire life, he'd believed that Teresa Reuters was his biological mother, and finding out he'd been lied to did not sit well with him. Something else I've found to be quite common is that adopted children who are not told they're adopted until much later in life often speak of always having had a profound sense that something is not quite right with their lives. This isn't some sort of supernatural knowing, of course. It's just, I think, a form of unconscious observance and intuition. When adoptive caregivers choose to withhold information from the adopted, even if they really feel it's the right thing to do, they always know that they're holding on to that secret. Secrets do change the way we interact with the world and those around us, and children are incredibly perceptive. They may not know what they're sensing, but they know something isn't quite right. And who knows, maybe there is something about not being with our biological tribe that our bodies and subconscious rebels against. But I don't know so much about that. Because for many people, not being with their biological family feels better, both physically and mentally. Whatever it was, Kyle's mention of somehow feeling like an outsider despite being included a lot at school and having a stable home life could have something to do with that. And when he discovered the truth, a lot changed for him. During 2017 and 2018, Kyle claims that he tried to look for work but struggled. He did eventually get a job at a bookshop, and then several others after that. But his drug use had begun to take hold of his life, and he was often fired for not arriving for his shifts or not performing to requirements. Now, we don't really know exactly how bad Kyle's drug problem was, and there's no information about whether his aunt was aware of his issue or took any action to try and get him help. I also want to be very clear that at no point in the legal process would anyone say that what Kyle did was fueled by his drugs. He would sort of try and claim it had played a role, but the psychiatric and legal experts were definitive that his way of thinking and his actions were very likely going to happen anyway. Could they have been expedited by drug use? Certainly. But it wasn't the cause. In the reverse, in fact, it's not uncommon for individuals like Kyle, who, as I'll discuss later, had clear traits of antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy, to have substance use disorders, because they are so used to not feeling emotions the way the rest of us do. And often the chemicals in the drugs are the only thing that can briefly give them some sense of elation or any other so-called normal emotional experience. By 2019, Kyle and Lynette's paths had started to converge. Lynette was 32 years old and had been working for her employer for 6 years, and was well-loved and appreciated at her place of work. Kyle was 24, unemployed and still living with his aunt. He would later claim that early in the year, He'd gotten deep into debt with his drug dealer, and he was having trouble paying the man off. On the other side of this reality, he was also spending most of his time living in a dream world. Kyle's bedroom bookshelf was stacked with books about serial killers. It was a fascination he'd had from quite young, and he'd begun to journal in a diary. But the diary was not the ordinary type where someone might use it to reflect on the day-to-day happenings of their lives and how they might feel about it. Rather, Kyle's diary contained a combination of lists, short notes about his goals, and what really came across as the type of statements you might see when someone is trying to manifest something. Now, bear with me here, because things are about to get a little strange. If you've ever heard about a book called The Secret, you might know about the concept of manifestation, where some people believe that if you say something, envision it, and almost live it out in your brain enough, you can attract it into your life in a physical manifestation. And tied to that, you might know about the practice of gratitude journaling, where instead of living in what's called a lack mindset, where you focus on all the stuff you don't have, instead you focus on all the things you do have. And you journal about the things in your life that you're grateful for in the hope that this will create what's called an abundance mindset, and you will attract more good things into your life. So Kyle, and really this is just my interpretation of what I saw, really seemed to be trying to manifest into his life that he would become a serial killer. And not just any serial killer, but the world's best serial killer, in his own words. He also seemed to be writing gratitude statements about aspects of his personality he apparently liked. One example was, "I'm grateful that I am a charming psychopath." Kyle Raters had set himself a goal, and that goal was to become a serial killer. He did also write about some relatively normal goals in his diary. He wanted to get a car and stop using drugs, but interspersed among those were shocking and horrifying objectives, like the one that read, "Have sex with one of the women from my slaves list." Kyle's slaves list was the other half of his dark obsession, and one that very much led into the other quite seamlessly. The young man clearly saw women as nothing more than physical objects. Whether or not his view of women was shaped by finding out that his mother had abandoned him is really unknown. But Kyle had a very misogynistic view of women. His writing shows that he saw women as essentially useful for nothing more than sex. He showed a huge amount of anger toward women in generally believing that they were simply money hungry and didn't actually want solid relationships with what he termed good men and only cared about how much money they could get out of a partner. If you're familiar with the term incel, which is short for involuntary celibate, and how that group of people think about women, you'll see the similarities with that in how Kyle thinks and expresses himself. Sadly, it's a worldview that is being promoted more and more by what I feel are predatory content creators online who want to make their fortune off skewing the views and manipulating the thoughts and actions of impressionable young men who can easily latch on to a narrative that tells them someone or a whole gender of people is to blame for all their problems. And that is clearly part of where Kyle was in his life at the time. But that was only part of it. It did feed into the victim type he would start to focus on, though. You heard me mention a slave list earlier. And that is one of the deeply disturbing parts of the diary entries Kyle was making. A large part of them were dedicated to identifying and stalking what he believed were going to be future victims of his. Many of the women on the list were women he'd had interactions with, who he perceived as rejecting him in some way. These were women who he'd only briefly met, perhaps in passing at a coffee shop or at one of his jobs. Most of them would probably not even remember the interaction, but he had begun to fixate on them. Kyle physically stalked many of these victims. He made notes of their comings and goings and mentioned some of the ways he might kill the woman and what he could gain financially from their deaths. Now, although there seemed to be a sexual element to these fantasies, and Kyle did view himself as a ladies' man, one of his goals was to have sex with 1,000 women, that didn't necessarily seem to be the focus of the crimes he was planning, at least not that he openly mentioned. What is very clear from his writings is that Kyle believed that he was destined to become a killer, and he was going to make that happen. He actively researched ways to kill people and ways to destroy evidence. He even claimed he'd taken courses on forensics and criminal investigation. He made detailed lists of the things he would need to carry out his crimes, and he developed what he called a kidnap kit, which contained a machete, a piece of rope, and a mask, which he carried around with him quite often. As the months ticked by in 2019, Kyle had started to focus more on two specific targets. One was a young lady he'd met while working in a mall. He'd been stalking her without her knowledge for months and planned to abduct and kill her and steal her scooter. This woman's name was never made public, although she would later be informed of the threat on her life, as other women were, by police. The other woman was Lynette Volskenk. The woman lived on the 10th floor of Siersich, while Kyle and his aunt lived on the 9th floor. He'd very likely just seen Lynette as she entered and exited her flat. The first instance, completely by chance, perhaps. He would never say exactly what had drawn him to her. Lynette seemed like a friendly enough lady, so maybe it was as insignificant as her smiling a hello to him as they passed in the hallway. But soon Kyle was watching her every movement. He knew what time she left for work and what time she returned. He knew when she went away for the weekend. And after enough time had passed, he also knew she lived alone. Perhaps most disturbingly, police would later find videos Kyle had made of Lynette moving around the building. She'd had no idea he was following her and filming her. And he referred to those videos when he wrote out his plan to kill her. 2019 was a terrifying year for the residents of the Siersich apartment block. On the 5th of May, neighbours went to investigate when they heard a really loud television set blaring throughout the night. When they figured out which flat the sound was coming from, they immediately realised something was wrong. The security gate on the flat was broken, and the door was standing slightly open, which made the television sound echo down the hallway. The neighbours knocked and called into the flat, but got no response, so they slowly eased open the door and walked inside. In the lounge, they found the 65-year-old male resident of the flat, dead on his lounge floor. The flat had been ransacked, and his body had been entirely bound with rope. The pathologist would later estimate that he'd been dead for about 36 hours. Now, I will say up front that this murder has never been definitively linked to Kyle Raters. The victim is not similar to the victim profile Kyle described in his writings, nor his eventual confirmed victim. This case does not seem to have been solved. And it must have been absolutely terrifying for residents when just 4 months later, it happened again. There are two ways that I could tell the rest of the story. One way would be to start when the victim is discovered and work backward and then forward again. And the other is just to tell it the way it happened. You already know who the perpetrator is in this case, so I feel like it makes more sense just to use the eventual plea statement that would be made, which I guess is as close to the truth as we'll get, to tell it from start to finish. I must warn you, many parts of this are very disturbing and gruesome. On the 21st of August 2019, around 4 p.m., Kyle Raters was watching Lynette Falskink's flat when he saw her arrive home from work with some shopping bags. It's unclear whether this was the day Kyle had actually planned his attack for, or if it was just a matter of him seeing the opportunity present itself. But he says that when she unlocked her security gate and front door, she didn't immediately pull it closed behind her because her hands were full of shopping bags, and instead she moved into the kitchen to put the bags down. As she did this, Kyle slipped in behind her and shut the door. The reason I think that this was not necessarily the planned day for the attack and more opportunistic is because Kyle didn't have any weapons with him. Instead, he pulled a knife off Lynette's own kitchen counter. Now, it is of course possible that he'd seen the block of knives when walking past her apartment if the door was open, and figured he could use those to avoid having to bring something with him that might help identify him if found. Kyle says that as soon as Lynette saw him in her kitchen, she screamed. The scream was heard by a neighbour, who says they called security and asked them to investigate, but it doesn't look like that actually happened. Instead, Kyle plunged the knife into Lynette's neck to silence her. He continued to stab at her several more times until she finally collapsed. Lynette did fight back, though. Even though her body would be in a terrible condition when found, the forensic pathologist was able to see defensive wounds on her arms and hands. Kyle was fueled by months of fantasy and planning, and his attack was brutal. Even if the exact day and time of the murder was not pre-planned, everything else Kyle did went exactly according to what he'd researched and planned in advance to do. He'd already decided that the best way to dispose of Lynette's body would be to dismember her. He searched Lynette's flat for something he could use and found a small handheld saw. He dragged Lynette from the kitchen into the bathroom and began dismembering her. A few hours in, he realized that the tools he had were not going to work, and he decided to clean himself up, go home, and return the next morning with more appropriate tools. I think what Kyle did next says a lot about the type of individual he is. He went downstairs to his flat, got undressed, showered, put on clean clothes, ate dinner, and then went to sleep. He did not go out and score drugs to numb what he'd just done. He didn't lay awake in his bed thinking about the fact that his neighbor's body was laying partially dismembered in the flat above. He just went to sleep. And the next morning at 7 a.m., Kyle was up and back in Lynette's flat. He'd locked up the night before and made sure the corridor was empty before letting himself back in. While there, his phone records would show that he'd Googled the opening times of a nearby hardware store. The previous night, Kyle had managed to dismember some parts of Lynette's body, including her head. And as he headed downstairs to the hardware store, he placed Lynette's head in a backpack and took it down with him. CCTV from outside the hardware store would later show him walking past with the backpack slung over his back. He returned minutes later and entered the store without the bag. It would later be revealed that he dropped the bag into some bushes nearby, hidden from sight. Inside the store, Kyle purchased a pair of plastic gloves and a large saw. He then returned to Siersich and Lynette's apartment. Over the next few hours, he proceeded to dismember Lynette's body into 9 pieces. He distributed the pieces between several cooler boxes he'd taken from both his and Lynette's flats. When he was satisfied that the remains were prepped for him to finally dispose of, he began cleaning up the flat. CCTV showed him going down to the main apartment dumpsters and disposing of several bloodied items. He then went back upstairs and, amazingly, started painting the walls of Lynette's apartment in the areas where blood had gotten onto the walls. Kyle's plan, it would emerge, was to delay or completely thwart the discovery that Lynette was deceased by making it look like she'd gone on a Bible camp for the weekend. He seemed to think that when she didn't return, the investigation into her being missing would just end up running cold, and he would get away with it. He'd even drafted a message that he planned to publish on Lynette's Facebook account after he killed her, saying that she'd gone away for the weekend. He didn't get around to doing that, though, because having not had much of a working career himself, and certainly never having worked anywhere long enough for his colleagues to become close with him, Kyle didn't take into account that when Lynette hadn't arrived for work that morning and couldn't be reached on her cell phone, her colleagues were immediately concerned. Unlike Kyle, Lynette was hardly ever late for work. She hardly ever took a sick day either. And when she did, she always called in. She was dedicated and hardworking and reliable. Her colleagues loved that about her, and they cared for her as a human being. So on that morning, when Lynette was nowhere to be found, a few of them got together around lunchtime and drove through to her flat. Her colleagues knocked on the door for quite some time before the door was opened. Before them stood a young man they didn't recognize, with blue gloves on his hands. They asked him if Lynette was home, and he said no, she wasn't. She'd gone away for the weekend and asked him to clean her flat while she was away. The colleagues were unconvinced. They could smell paint in the flat, and they all knew Lynette as an intensely private person. She didn't have any domestic help around the house and did all her own housework. Something did not feel right. The young man wouldn't let them in, though, saying he didn't think Lynette would like it if he let strangers into her house. So her colleagues went back downstairs. But they didn't leave. Instead, they phoned police and explained what was happening. Within 15 minutes, a single police car arrived at Siersich. The patrol officer reporting very likely thought it would be a standard call-out. He'd chat to the young man, maybe reach the resident on her phone, and confirm that everything was okay, and then he'd be on his way. Of course, that wasn't nearly what happened. Instead, he walked into one of the most horrific calls of his career. I do wonder what went through Kyle Rater's mind when he opened the door to a police officer. Maybe in his narcissistic head, he even thought he could talk his way out of it. But he couldn't. And soon the police officer was inside the flat. And the sight of 9 cooler boxes lined up next to each other next to the front door, was far too unusual to ignore. What he discovered when he lifted the lid of one was beyond anything he'd experienced. Within minutes of the officer arriving, Kyle Raters was arrested and handcuffed. Her colleagues waiting outside likely realized something was terribly amiss when many more police cars began to surround the building, and then they were told a body had been found. One of Lynette's co-workers often posts on her social media on the anniversary of the day, recalling how they were all completely in shock, and most people in the office just went home because no one could process what had just happened. The horrific details of what actually occurred would take a while to filter out, but Lynette's sister received a telephone call informing her that it was believed her sister had been murdered. Of course, no one could definitively say it was Lynette until either DNA or fingerprints confirmed it, because although most of her body parts were in the cooler boxes, her head was no longer in the apartment. Lynette's sister's husband was overseas at the time, and he had to book an emergency flight back to South Africa to support his wife. As all those who had loved Lynette struggled with the news, Kyle Raters was transported back to Bellville Police Station, and an investigating officer was waiting there to interview him. At first, Raters denied having anything to do with the murder, claiming the cooler boxes had been there when he'd arrived to start painting and cleaning the flat on Lynette's instruction. But the I.O. soon pointed to the dried blood under Kyle's fingernails and tiny spots of blood on his pants, which he obviously hadn't noticed. Even after admitting he had killed her, though, Kyle gave the police the runaround as to where Lynette's head was. After giving them a few false locations, the officer sat him down and explained to him that if Lynette's family did not have her entire body to bury, they would struggle to find closure. He also mentioned it would look a lot better for him in court if he cooperated with them. It was far more likely the latter than the former that changed Kyle's mind, but he did eventually point out where he'd left the rest of Lynette's remains. The I.O. would later testify in court that he was very grateful that he was close to retirement, and this would probably be his last murder case, because he had never seen anything like what Kyle Raters had done to Lynette Volskenk. And he hoped in his life he'd never have to see anything similar again. Initially, at least publicly, people seemed to believe the narrative that Kyle Raters was a drug addict who had randomly targeted Lynette to be able to steal from her and pay for drugs. But over his first few court appearances, as bits and pieces of evidence began to be revealed, it became clear that this was something far, far worse. Teresa Raters did not ever speak with the media after the arrest of her adopted son and biological nephew. I can only imagine the horror of hearing what he'd done, and then the simultaneous situation of her being an advocate, who often worked cases in Bellville, in front of the very judges and defense attorneys who were in her nephew's court proceedings. She did attend the first few court sessions and was supported by some friends and colleagues who shielded her from photographers and journalists. It soon became clear that the investigation was going to take quite some time as police began to retrieve Kyle's diaries and the content on his cell phone. They also had to track down the other women mentioned in the diary and make sure they were okay. And of course, they couldn't really do that without explaining why they were there. I can't even imagine what it must have been like for those women to have police turn up on their doorsteps and inform them that they had almost been the victim of someone who wanted to be a serial killer. And they had been victims of stalking, but they had no idea they were being watched. As police went from victim to victim, Kyle's victim type became clear. They were all young, between 18 and 35, all attractive white women. Most of them worked full-time, had their own transportation of some form, and many lived alone. Every time Kyle attended court, he had insults thrown at him from the gallery. He would eventually withdraw his bail application. There were probably a few reasons for this, besides the fact that he may be in danger on the outside. His only fixed address was his aunt's home in the Seersich apartments, and the residents there could not be expected to have the young man living in the same building as them while he awaits a trial. In addition, his diaries had brought to light that he'd intended to save up to travel to Johannesburg so that he could kill his biological mother. With there being so many women he'd very clearly stalked, those victims also could not be put at risk. In early September, Lynette was laid to rest. Her family requested privacy for the funeral and noted that no media would be allowed access. By December that year, Kyle had changed lawyers. His first lawyer withdrew, and although the reason for his withdrawal was never specified, there were rumours that Kyle had left out a lot of the evidence in his version to his lawyer, and it had only come to light when the prosecution had made him aware. Defence lawyers cannot do their jobs if their clients are not honest with them, and it's not the first time I've heard of a defence counsel withdrawing after discovering their client's dishonesty. And as I've mentioned before about cases that occurred in 2019 and 2020, the COVID lockdown deeply affected the court system, and we're really only now catching up to our previously already delayed turnaround. And it would be no different with this case, unfortunately. Because of the nature of the crime and, of course, the writings found in his room, Kyle Raters would be sent for a psychiatric assessment. Again, as I've said before, those assessments are also incredibly delayed, and the pandemic would not help that at all. As with so many people in what is essentially a hospital setting, patients were put at high risk for contracting COVID from forensic patients being moved into the wards from the correctional centres. As a result of all these combined delays, it would be 2023. Before Kyle Raters' trial could begin in earnest. His psychiatric assessment had found that at the time of the crime there were no psychiatric issues that would mean he would not have been capable of telling the difference between right and wrong, and that he was fit to stand trial. There was, however, an additional note on the assessment, which would later be discussed in court and acted upon to an extent by the judge. The reporting psychiatrist had recommended that should the court see fit, they would recommend Kyle Raters be returned to the psychiatric facility for an additional assessment, one which would help to determine whether he was in fact what is legally defined as a dangerous offender. I've discussed the dangerous offender determination on this podcast before, and go into it in quite a bit of detail in my book Sizzlers too. But it's certainly worth re-explaining here. The determination is a legal tool which can be used in the most severe of criminal cases, in which an offender is found through psychiatric and other assessment to be a particular threat to society, in that he or she is going to be very difficult to rehabilitate. As you'll know, we do not have a life without parole sentence in South Africa. After the death penalty was abolished, our longest sentence is life. Life in South Africa means that you serve a minimum detention period of 25 years, and then you become eligible for parole. Parole is assessed through the Department of Correctional Services. And even if you're released on parole, you remain under the auspices of that department for the rest of your natural life. And should you break any of your parole conditions, you can be sent back to prison to continue serving your sentence behind bars. The dangerous offender determination takes that sentence to a step further, or maybe rather a step parallel. When an offender is legally deemed to be dangerous after being found guilty, he or she will then no longer automatically become eligible for parole at 25 years and go through the parole review process with the DCS. Rather, they will return to court and appear in front of a judge at the 20-year mark. And in a mini-trial, the judge will decide whether the offender may or may not be considered for parole. If the judge decides that they are not ready for possible release, they can then set the period of time for the next review, which could be 10 years, for instance. Essentially, this adds in extra steps and safeguards to ensure that a dangerous offender does not slip through the cracks of the parole system and get released. Unfortunately, this determination is not used nearly enough in our courts. I think that's mainly because our courts are overloaded and under-resourced, like many of our other systems. And it's quite a lot of additional work to get this determination put through. As mentioned, the process for the determination can only begin after the accused is found guilty. So even if Kyle Raters was to be considered for this, he had to be found guilty first. Thankfully, Kyle seemed to realize by this time that there was no way he was getting out of this. He'd literally been caught red-handed, and all the evidence pointed to him as the killer. So when asked to plead to charges of murder, violating a corpse, and attempting to defeat the ends of justice, he entered a plea of guilty on all counts. When his plea statement was read out, it became clear that he was trying to downplay his motive for the murder, rather trying to shift it to one of a financial nature than the intrinsic desire to kill it had seemed to be. Kyle blamed his drug habit, essentially, saying that he'd built up a 30,000 rand drug debt with his dealer who was threatening him. He claimed that this was when he'd started planning to kill people, but only to steal from them, so he could pay his dealer off. This, of course, made no sense, because he'd had little to no financial benefit from Lynette's murder, and it was very clear from his writings that he was motivated to kill, simply for the sake of killing. The state and the judge accepted his guilty pleas, though, as motive had no significance in the South African legal system, and Kyle was admitting the important stuff. He'd planned Lynette's murder, he had desecrated her body, and he had tried to mislead police. He was therefore found guilty of all three charges against him. Then the judge ruled that Kyle Raters should, as the psychiatric panel had recommended and the prosecution had now also requested, go back to the facility for another 30 days for a dangerous offender assessment. A few months later, Raters was back in court for the sentencing phase of his trial. The state first presented their evidence in aggravation, which included Lynette's sister's victim impact statement. I will read the details of this directly from the judgment. Quote, "The loss of the deceased and the monstrous brutality which accompanied it had an extremely traumatic impact on the family. In a victim impact statement that was handed up by the prosecutor from the sister of the deceased, this fact is clearly evident. She states that she suffers from nightmares. As a hairdresser, she cannot trust any male persons. She lost faith in her fellow human beings and in the goodness of mankind. She suffers from permanent anxiety to the extent that she loses bladder control when people shout or argue. She had withdrawn herself from being part of big groups of people. She is also scared to go outside of her house out of fear of being attacked. The deceased was her best friend and only sister. It is difficult for her to live a normal life. Although she received psychological treatment for a few months, she, however, would have to undergo such treatments for the rest of her life. End quote. This underpins the fact that regardless of what sentence or determination an offender gets, it is always the family of the victim that gets the real life sentence. For them, there is no parole from their grief or hope that rehabilitation will mean a new life can be lived beyond what they've experienced. Their lives are forever changed. The dangerous offender assessment was also read into evidence, and the panel of experts had found that Kyle Raters did indeed meet the requirements of that determination. Quote, Mr. Raters represents a danger to the physical and mental well-being of other persons. He should be declared a dangerous criminal as per Section 286A of the Criminal Procedure Act 51 of 1977. From a psychiatric point of view, he shows no genuine remorse for the offence, deceitfulness, and a pervasive pattern of violating the rights of others. He was assessed as having antisocial personality disorder, a diagnosis which offers a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. End quote. Of course, this was simply one part of the process. The judge would still have the final say. And after he'd heard the defence's factors in mitigation of sentence, which included a letter from Kyle Raters expressing his alleged remorse, the judge adjourned to make his decision. Ultimately, the judge made a decision that some would question for some time to come. He was of the legal view that handing down the dangerous offender determination would actually risk Kyle serving less time than he would with a life sentence. Many legal minds I've spoken with and who've been interviewed about this decision do not agree with that. Yes, the offender does come before a judge at 20 years rather than coming before a parole board at 25 years, but there would only be a very slim chance that any judge would actually condone parole at that stage. It's never happened to someone deemed a dangerous offender before. And even if that slim chance did come to fruition, it's likely that the minimum detention period of 25 years would still kick in. But there's no legislation that firmly points to this being the case, the judge expressed. And he was not willing to take the chance. And so he handed down a life sentence to Kyle Raters, without the dangerous offender determination. He did, however, order that all documents related to this case, including the psychiatric assessments and the autopsy and crime scene photos, be included in Raters' prison file, so that any future parole board would have a clear view of what he had done and the significance of him being unleashed back into society. And so, Kyle Raters was led down to start serving his sentence. Kyle Raters will be eligible for parole in 2044. He will be 49 years old. In his podcast episode about this case, Dr. Gerard Labuschagne mentioned that he has heard that since his incarceration, Kyle Raters has joined the 28s number gang. The 28s are known for having the most dangerous and violent offenders in the Western Cape among their number. I couldn't help but wonder, when I heard this, if Kyle finally feels like he belongs. As you know, the vast majority of murders are committed by someone known to the victim. In a lot of cases I cover, the perpetrator is very close to the victim, often their abuser for years before the murder occurs. And although in this case Lynette was known to Kyle, Kyle was not necessarily known to Lynette. She likely would have recognized his face from seeing him in the hallway, but I don't think she would have known his name, or probably even anything about him. She certainly didn't know Kyle had been stalking her for weeks, months even, before he killed her. Although the actual murder in this case is undoubtedly heinous, I almost feel the stalking part is equally terrifying. I don't know about you, but I often think of stalkers as people who want to be known to their victims. People who insert themselves into their victims' lives and have fantasies of some kind of relationship with them. Or someone who was close to the victim at one point and now refuses to leave them alone. But what Kyle did is different. It is technically stalking, but it's more like hunting, a form of predation. And I can think of very few things more terrifying than discovering that someone has been watching you for months, logging your movements, learning your patterns, studying your social media posts for clues, all without you having any idea at all that it's happening. Because that, as Kyle proved, could really happen to anyone. The weekend before Lynette was murdered, she, her sister, and her brother-in-law went on a spur-of-the-moment getaway to the mountains. Her brother-in-law spoke of the last photograph he'd ever taken of Lynette from across a bonfire. In retrospect, the photograph is both eerie and incredibly beautiful. In it, the flames dance between the camera lens and Lynette. She sits around the fire, next to her sister, and both women are smiling. Puffs of condensation are captured around their heads as they speak into the cold night air. And this, combined with the heat from the flames, creates almost a blurred image of Lynette. It looks as though, if you could fast forward that photo, she would disappear before your eyes. And, for all intents and purposes, just 4 days later, she did. That photo represents three moments of finality. It was the last time the family would be together. It was the last time Lynette was captured on camera, smiling. And it was the last time her sister would smile in that exact way. Because that exact smile was undoubtedly reserved for her sister. She would smile again, eventually. But that moment, that look of love, would never be repeated. That night, they would go to bed, tired from the mountain air and the late night, and have absolutely no idea that all those final moments had just happened. Lynette Fullskenk, rest gently. And now it's time for my interview with international investigative journalist and author Tim Tate. It's always an honour for me to speak with individuals both locally and from overseas who've dedicated their lives to seeking justice for the victims of violent crime, and so much of Tim's work over the years has been aimed at doing just that in various forms. I gave you a summary of the new TV series Tim takes part in the beginning of this episode, but I'll repeat it here in case you can't remember or you're listening to the ad-free version of this episode. The hunt for the Chameleon Killer is being broadcast on CBS Justice. Over 3 episodes, the series reveals the global hunt, which took place for Elaine Parent, dubbed the Chameleon Killer, who was at one time the most wanted woman in the world, and who managed to evade US law enforcement for over 12 years, while stealing a string of identities along the way. I had the great pleasure of talking to Tim about how a tiny sheriff's office in Florida managed to connect Elaine Parent to the murder of 34-year-old Beverly McGowan in 1990, whose headless, handless body was discovered in a local canal, and the dramatic end to the police search. Sometimes, truth really is stranger than fiction. And here is my interview with Tim, detailing some of that strange truth. When and how did Elaine Parent first come onto your radar as a journalist?
It would have been in around about 1999-2000 when a press release was reproduced in the British press, just a small story about a press release from St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office in Florida, who were seeking information and help trying to track down someone they called the Chameleon. And this woman, whose name was Elaine Parent, was quickly dubbed the world's most wanted woman because police quite literally all over the world, law enforcement quite literally all over the world, was trying to find her. And I saw this story and I thought, well, that's fascinating. I think there's a film in this. And so I picked up the phone, did what any journalist would do. I picked up the phone and rang the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department and said, can I talk to you? And they said, oh, yes, please. And we went on to make, a film in 2002 about Parent, who was at that point still in the wind. She was still eluding, as she had done for 20 years, law enforcement's best efforts to catch her. And she did that right up until, I think, a day or 2 days before I finished that original film, because I was in the edit and just finishing the last bits of the edit when I got a phone call from St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department, and they said, she's dead. She killed herself last night with a .357 revolver, shot herself through the heart, while Florida cops from a different part of Florida were trying to arrest her. Dear God, that's a melodramatic end to a thoroughly dramatic life. But what do I do? I'm just about to finish the film. So I managed to change the ending of the film and we got that in. But from then on, I was even more fascinated. I wanted to know, how had this woman evaded justice for so long? Who had helped her, and what failings in law enforcement had enabled that? And I think in the series, The Hunt for the Chameleon Killer, we're able to answer at least some of those questions.
In many of the stories you've told over your career, whether in writing or film, women ordinarily take the form of the underdog or survivor who go on to overcome incredible odds and succeed. But the story of Elaine Parent is very different. What was that like for you as a storyteller to adjust your lens to this deeply flawed character?
She is or was a truly fascinating character. And one of the things I was very anxious to do right from the start was to try and explore what drove Elaine Parent to do what she did. Not just this brutal murder of a young woman in Florida, but a lifetime career as a con artist extraordinaire, identity thief, and a vampiric feeder on other women's lives, because virtually all of her victims, whatever happened to them, were women. And I wanted to try and get under the woman's skin and find out what drove her. And I was very lucky to work with a forensic clinical psychologist called Barbara Cohen, who's in The Hunt for the Chameleon Killer. And Barbara is very, very, very good at analyzing criminal behavior, and I think particularly female criminal behavior. And in the end, this is Barbara's expertise, but I absolutely agreed with it. She came to believe that Elaine Parent had completely lost any sense of who she was. And the only way she could keep going, rather like a shark, I suppose, in the ocean, is to keep going and swallowing other people's identities and take over their lives so that Elaine Parent didn't exist, but Mont did, or Charlotte Ray Cowan did. And that was how Elaine Parent kept moving forward.
In my experience, female offenders often tend to get away with quite a lot more than their male counterparts before they're identified and apprehended. Possibly because of these societal constructs that make us trust women more than men. Do you think that if Elaine was a man, she would have had more difficulty getting away with quite as much as she did?
It's always difficult, isn't it? The what if? What if she had not been a woman? What if she had not been a genuinely beautiful woman? I think probably my best guess, and it's only a guess, is that's true. She would not have got away so frequently with what she did if she were a man. But the other thing I think we have to factor into this is almost all of this took place before 9/11. And before 9/11, it was less difficult to get away with this, be you a man or a woman. And you know, I don't think you can overstate the importance of that context.
I agree with you. And, you know, the way that she seemed to sort of ingratiate herself into her victims' lives, there was definitely an element of trust there. And what something I found fascinating was one of the individuals mentioning in the documentary that many Americans say that they immediately find the British accent sets them at ease and makes them think of a person who's highly educated and trustworthy.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we should recognize is that Parent was extraordinarily skilled, not just as at impersonating other women from any number of different countries, but in very quickly zeroing in on her victim, her mark, if you want, and working out what it is they want to hear. They wanted to hear. What did that woman need to hear? What would enable Parent to inveigle herself into her life? And as you say, in many cases, that was the British accent. In other cases, it was the incredibly detailed stories she wove, she made up, but she wove, about her life in, for example, South Africa. She said she told these extraordinarily convoluted stories, full of detail, about her life in exotic locations, South Africa being one of them. And particularly with the vulnerable women with whom she became involved, it was catnip. You know, this is a glamorous, intelligent, cultivated woman who has lived in all of these glamorous locations. And she's interested in me. Parent was exceptionally skilled at this, and that's what made her so dangerous.
To your knowledge, were the sightings of Elaine in other countries, including South Africa, ever actually confirmed?
Yes and no. When we were making the series, I got the entire investigative file from the Florida Attorney General's Department. It's vast. I mean, it's tens of thousands of individual pages of documents and photographs and some recordings. And that took a while to analyze, I can tell you. What is absolutely certain is that Parent flitted in and out of and lived in the UK for lengthy periods, preying on victims and sometimes with the assistance of her lover in the UK. She I found evidence that she had operated, targeted, victimized primarily women all over the states, quite literally all over the states. In terms of the other locations, and we're talking South Africa, Australia, France, amongst many others, these were sightings that came into St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department after the murder in 1990, the murder that Parent carried out, and while she was still on the run. And the problem with it is that St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department is tiny. It is a small, really rural location. The Sheriff's Department doesn't have a huge amount of resources. And getting international law enforcement cooperation is incredibly difficult. I got to know the detectives quite well in St. Lucie County, and they have my utter admiration for the way they've pursued this. But the help, the assistance they got or didn't get from law enforcement internationally is shocking. I mean, the Metropolitan Police here in London was obstructive to the nth degree. And that's one of the lessons that I drew out of this, that what makes it easier for someone as skilled as Parent was to operate is the incompetence and sclerotic nature of international law enforcement cooperation. Given that, it's not that difficult to slip between the cracks and slip between the fingers.
You've told the stories of many different types of criminals throughout your career as well. What are some of the similarities and differences you saw when you compare Elaine with some of the other offenders you've dealt with?
Yeah, I mean, I should say I'm not actually a true crime, not what I've specialized in. You know, I'm an investigative journalist. The Parent story interested me not just because she was a fascinating psychological study, but because of what it illustrated about the systemic problems. And, you know, I think that's part of the job for people like me is to say, here's a problem, a systemic problem. You know, if journalists like me don't flag that up, then nothing's ever going to get done. In terms of the similarities, I honestly don't think there were any. I think Parent was almost unique. I mean, she was uniquely skilled at stealing identities and in becoming different people, hence the chameleon. And I think her pathology was unusual, to put it mildly. I mean, I've not come across many women offenders with that level of psychological illness, I suppose, it's at its base level. There are generally, if you want to be really simplistic about this, two motives for murder: sex and money. And when you get the confluence of both, then things start to get a bit lively. And I think with Parent, you've got that. And then you add on the generally unspoken element, which is mental illness or psychological problems. And she had those by the bucket load. For all of those reasons, I think in the 47 years I've been a journalist, her story is unique. That doesn't, however, mean that the problems it highlights, the systemic problems it highlights, are unique, because they are systemic.
Initially, when I started reading about this case, I was quite surprised at the crossover between fraud crimes and a really brutal murder. But then when I thought about it, at least here in South Africa, and certainly some cases in the US as well, it's actually not uncommon for female serial killers, particularly, to pair their murders up with a financial gain element. In a lot of these cases, though, the financial element ends up masking the actual motive, which is power and control. and the money is just sort of a side bonus. Does any of that ring true in Elaine's case for you?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things to go back to the start of your question. We don't know that Elaine Parent is a serial killer. What we do know is that there are around 20 women's identities, women essentially, who have never been traced, whom Parent assumed their identities, and no one knows where they are, or even if they ever actually existed. Is she a serial killer? No, technically she's not. Could she be? Yes, very well, she could be. As to, you know, what drove her, and I had the same reaction as you, what drove her to commit not just murder, but this extraordinarily brutal murder? And Bev McGowan's body was desecrated. I mean, her head was cut off, her feet were cut off. It stuck out to me. It stuck from the very first day I began looking at this. It stuck out to me. This isn't the normal pathology of a con artist, however good a con artist. It's not the typical financial criminal pathology. And so with Barbara Cohen, the clinical psychologist, you know, we explored this endlessly, Barbara and I. And I think I can only bow to her much greater real expertise in this. Not, I don't have expertise in this, experience, but not expertise. And Barbara's view is that it was about rejection. You know, Parent had thought she had taken over this young woman's life, Beverly McGowan's life. And at some point, Bev realized, hold on, something's not right here, and put the brakes on. And because of her fractured mental state, I don't think that Elaine Parent knew who Elaine Parent was. She couldn't handle rejection. And I certainly saw that in the way that she behaved to her lover and occasional accomplice in London. I mean, her behavior to that woman was terrifying. When Parent felt rejected by her. And I think that rings true, that Beverly McGowan died because Parent's mind essentially melted down because Beverly was rejecting her. That's Barbara Cohen's view. It's my view. But nothing is ever simple in all of this. The police, the cops in St. Lucie County and elsewhere, were and are convinced that Parent had an accomplice, at least one accomplice, a male accomplice. You think what happened to Beverly McGowan? She is apparently abducted from her home in Pompano Beach. She's driven 100 miles north. Either she's dead by that point or she's dead when she reaches St. Lucie County. She's dismembered somewhere, and her body is thrown down a banking. Now, I've been to that banking by that canal. You couldn't possibly do that all on your own. And however strong Elaine Parent was, and she was a fit woman, she could not have done that on her own. And the cops believe, with absolute justification in my view, that Parent had an accomplice who either helped murder Bev McGowan or carried out the murder. And if you factor that in, that changes the picture of Parent's pathology. And what makes it so frustrating is that the only person who really knows the answer, other than possibly the accomplice, is Parent herself, and she took her secrets to the grave.
Although she wasn't convicted of the murder, Elaine is, of course, the prime suspect in the murder of Beverly McGowan. The dismemberment of the victim's body immediately leads me to believe that this possibly wasn't her first murder, because that's not generally an act that a first-time killer commits. From your investigation into this case, are you aware of any of her other identities linking up to missing people? And what do you think the likelihood is that she had killed before and perhaps after Beverly?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you'll know this just as well as I do, probably better. You can read that level of dismemberment as either an organized, calculating killer seeking to cover their tracks, or you can see it as an anger killing, which is going to be less organized, or you can see it as a collaboration between people who may share some or all of those pathologies. Without the extra bits of information, I don't think you're ever going to solve that conundrum.
I know that investigators were eventually able to determine where Elaine was born and who her parents were. But was anything more concrete uncovered about her childhood? Does she have any surviving family members who could shed light on her background?
As with everything to do with Elaine Parent, the official records are a mess. So in the official records, there are two Elaine Parents with precisely the same social security number. Now, that shouldn't happen, should it? What we know is, I know where she was born in New York. I know where she lived and went to school in New York and then Wisconsin and then Illinois. But in that period of what happened within her childhood and her teenage years, it's pretty much a blank. She was an only child, though she had cousins. And the first time I really was able to pick up a paper trail, an absolutely copper-bottom primary source paper trail, was in Florida. And by that time, it's 1975, and she was then 32, 33. And that's when she begins committing provable offences. And all of them are offences of dishonesty. I mean, she gets done for shoplifting. Then she, as a realtor in Florida, a licensed realtor in Florida, she runs a series of scams stealing deposits. And then with her new lover and this British woman who is christened Miss X in the film, though we do know who she is, Parent commits a jewel heist and flees with her lover, with Miss X, to London. And that's in 1985. She spends 5 years in London stealing identities, giving Miss X a pretty torrid time, before going back and killing Beverly McGowan. But all of the story, as viewers to the series will see, is far more complicated and far more puzzling than that. And every time that the police came close to nicking her, to finding her, she slipped through their fingers. And it's this extraordinary, picaresque, Byzantine tale. And that's just what we fitted into three one-hour films. The rest of her travels across the US, her crimes, and her aberrant behavior would make another 6 hours. We just don't have that space, sadly.
And that is my interview with Tim Tate. I strongly recommend you catch The Hunt for the Chameleon Killer on CBS Justice next week for more on this fascinating and tragic case. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.